Options reported during this program.
Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power. Now, here's your host, Jason Fornicola.
This week, we'll discuss the future of the U.S. labor movement with labor historian Dr. Nelson Lichtenstein, author of State of the Union, A Century of American Labor. We'll also get an update on contract negotiations at the Social Security Administration with AFGE SSA Council 220 President Witold Skwierczynski. Up first, Nelson Lichtenstein. Nelson is the director of the University of California at Santa Barbara's Center for the Study of Work, Labor, and Democracy. He's also the author of State of the Union, A Century of American Labor. Dr. Lichtenstein, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
So you've authored this fantastic book about the history of America's labor movement called State of the Union, A Century of American Labor. Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, the point of it, I think, is to show that really what the unions have sought to do, that the main thing, yes, wages, and that's important, and contracts, but they've tried to create a sense of citizenship at work. That is, to bring to the office and to the factory or wherever people work a certain sense of ordered liberty. I mean, that's a phrase that actually comes from, you know, Tom Jefferson and the founders. We think about that in terms of, you know, living in a society. We want the authoritarian dictatorships abroad to be people to be free. And really, I'm taking the same standards that we would apply to the Soviet Union or Libya or someplace like that, and saying what is the nature of freedom and liberty, and applying that to the workplace. And talking about, you know, citizenship, the nature of a certain kind of procedures, or a certain order, a way in which people resolve their grievances, their difficulties, and have the capacity to speak up. And then I apply that to the workplace. I talk about, well, from the progressive era, the 30s, and then more recently. And the union movement does all sorts of things, and most of the headlines are about negotiating wages or pensions more recently, but I think that its creation of a sense of citizenship is really even more fundamental.
Now, at the beginning of the book, right from the start, you used a great example about the application for employment at something like Burger King,
right,
and gave some examples,
right,
about,
right,
equal employment opportunities versus the ability to collectively bargain and at-will,
right,
employment and things like that. Could you share that example with us?
Well, yes. I mean, it's actually interesting. When I was visiting with my son, who was about, I don't know, probably 14 or 13 at the time, we went to have a hamburger, and this was during a period of probably the late 90s. I'm not sure when there was a bit of a employment boom, and the placemat on our Burger King little tray was an employment application. So I was sitting there waiting for the burger. I started reading. My son was reading it, and the top part, the very it said apply for Burger King, and then it said we don't discriminate, regardless of race, gender, age, military service, etc. We're an equal opportunity employer, and that was all in big sort of print, and we saw that. But then I guess the burger took longer to get, so then we flipped it over. And then in the very small print, toward the end, it said something like, Burger King is an at-will employer and therefore your employment contract at Burger King, is entirely, really at the discretion of the employer. And it was some other legal language of that sort. And my son said, what's that all about? I understand that, of course they aren't going to discriminate on the basis of my race or gender, et cetera. What's that? What's the rest of that? And the point of it is this, that today, as a result of the civil rights laws, the great advances, and I think that the 64 civil rights law and subsequent laws, and today protecting gay people, for example, one's citizenship, insofar as the criteria is your race or gender, et cetera, your attribute. This is well protected and is legitimate. And employers who get in trouble, who are found to be discriminating on that basis, they are brought to the humiliated in the court of public opinion. A lot of cases of that happening. However, when it comes to simply workers as workers and workers who seek to act collectively, the at-will doctrine means basically it's a 19th century doctrine that an employer has the right to fire you for good cause, for no cause, or for a whimsical cause. They have complete discretion. This is a 19th century, it's still a 19th century conception of really of master and servant doctrine at work. And when in collective bargaining contracts can change that. But today, with only 7% of workers in the private sector unionized, most people are not covered by a collective bargaining. So this is a big contradiction, which I try to explain in the book.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with Dr. Nelson Lichtenstein, author of State of the Union, A Century of American Labor. Dr. Lichtenstein, at the top, you mentioned all sorts of things that the labor movement has done along the way, and some things people may not even be aware of. Can you share some of that with us?
Well, right. I mean, I think the headlines are always about pensions or today maybe healthcare somewhat and wages. But I think most people have no idea, and this is because most people are not in a union. It's a foreign, it's an alien concept to them. They aren't aware. What unions do is on the daily activities of one's workplace, they are there to make certain that there's I use the phrase ordered liberty. That's a very conservative phrase, ordered liberty. That's what conservatives use when they talk about this is what American society should be. But I think that is essential. It's a phrase going back to the 18th century, and I think that's what unions do. In the workplace, create a sense of order and freedom. And that means predictability. That means if you have a problem, that means if you have an issue, if you adhere to your side of the sort of agreement, then the employer will have to adhere to his, whether it's promotions or hours or the kind of work, etc. Most Americans don't understand that. In fact, there was a survey taken a little while ago that most people think they have more rights at work than they do, but they don't. And I've studied Walmart, for example, and one of the greatest grievances of Walmart workers have is not that the wages are low, although they are, but that their work life is so unpredictable because the management can reduce their hours, fire them too, change their shift, and change the work, etc. And then basically they quit. I mean, there's tremendous turnover at Walmart. There's no sense of ordered liberty at Walmart from the point of view of the worker. And I think that is something that I teach my students. They assume they have more rights at work than they do. But when the crunch comes, an economic problem or just a dispute with a boss, they find that the at-will doctrine applies. That is, they can be fired for good cause, no cause, whimsical cause.
Now, you've kept a close eye on the assault against public sector workers in Wisconsin and New Jersey, Ohio, and elsewhere. But you also argue that these are just the most recent examples in a long line of labor bashing. Tell us about that.
Well, right. There's really never been a moment in American history when conservatives have been have sort of been at peace with or have accepted the trade unions. I think among trade unionists, by the way, there's a certain kind of back in the good old days or back in the 50s, there used to be more friendly employers or friendly political. I think actually that's a bit of a myth that we have, and I consider myself a trade union, that we have created. Employers and including government to some extent have disliked unions because they really they want from an employer point of view, they want freedom, their flexibility, they don't want any obstacles to their basically capacity to do whatever they want, and they've often viewed unions as racketeering. This phrase, the union boss, the conception of the union as sort of a racket or racketeering. Where did that come from? That is not a result of Jimmy Hoffa or the latest scandal, that some union leader absconded with the funds. That came out of the 1920s in Chicago, when unions were becoming strong in that city, and the Chicago Chamber of Commerce in the 20s invented the term racketeering. They were thinking about Al Capone and stuff like that, but what they were doing was saying that any union effort to set the general wage level, a competitive industry, say teamstering in the city or bartendering or cleaning up shirts, those kind of things, that this was ipso facto racketeering, not because there was anybody on the take, but because the market was the legitimate way to set the price of labor, and if you tried to do it in a more collective way, this was racketeering. And so that idea has stuck, and so you have this criminalized language, which employers and now public officials have often applied to unions, whether it's bosses, thuggishness, racketeering. And this really, what this means is that unions don't think the market is the most important and most legitimate thing in the world. They think that a kind of collective democratic decision making is, but that's demonized by conservatives as racketeering or thuggishness or bossism or what have you.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll continue with labor historian Dr. Nelson Lichtenstein.
Looking for a hassle-free way to buy a new computer, electronics, or home appliances? Purchasing Power allows you to buy items such as Dell laptops, HP desktops, and Kenmore appliances through easy payroll deduction. There's no upfront cash required, no credit checks, and AFGE members get a 6% discount with promo code AFGEMember. That's all one word. Get started today. Log on to shoppurchasingpower.com. That's shoppurchasingpower.com.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We're continuing with Dr. Nelson Lichtenstein, the author of State of the Union, A Century of American Labor. Dr. Lichtenstein is also the director of the University of California at Santa Barbara's Center for the Study of Work, Labor, and Democracy. Dr. Lichtenstein, before the break, we were talking about this attack against public workers in Wisconsin and New Jersey and Ohio and elsewhere. How important is it for not just those public sector unions, but all unions, the entire labor movement, to be fighting back against these attacks against their workplace protections?
Well, it's essential, because attack on these unions in the public sector in Wisconsin and other places, it's not just an issue of a budget deficit, that's an open question. I mean, yes, we have these states are strapped for money, but many studies have shown that the main reason is not, for example, high pensions. It's basically we have this terrible recession, and Congress has blocked relief to the states, which Obama has asked for. But really, the right has a much larger agenda, and they want to two things. They know they want to destroy the union movement, essentially, because the union movement is a pillar of those who oppose the agenda of the right. That is, the right's agenda is a effort to eliminate public services, to eliminate ultimately national health care and Social Security, etc. And the union movement is one of the strongest opponents of that politically. The unions function politically today as much as economically, not so much by giving money money to politicians, but by, you know, having their educating their own members and having their own members out there knocking on doors and doing activities of that sort. So one of the critiques of the conservatives today when it comes to public sector unions is that the problem with unions is they are supportive of a strong state, of a state, you know, that you know, does a lot of things. And our agenda, of course, is to dismantle the state. I mean, to you know, either outsource it or just eliminate, you know, all, you know, whatever it does, you know, in terms of education, create a kind of totally privatized system, and, you know, for everything else. And so it's sort of on the right. That's a fundamental a principle of the conservatives, and they say, well, who is against that? Well, one of the groups that's most organized and most articulate is, of course, the trade union movement. They say, yeah, the government has certain functions it should perform, whether it's, you know, fire or police or education. I mean, this seems like apple pie, but in fact, it's, you know, the union movement is the strongest, the most articulate force saying, yes, we should preserve the existence of, you know, state, local, and for that matter, federal government that does all these things. And so that's really part of the battle royal that's being waged in the today, you know, whether it's in Congress or anywhere else.
Now, you've made a strong argument that the existence of a democracy and the existence of a labor movement are connected. They're intertwined. Tell us about that.
Well, yes. I mean, first of all, as an historian and anyone thinking historically, when you think about the rise of democracy in over the last 200 years, I mean, and in every country, everywhere, there has been, you know, the rise of you know, the right of people to vote, lots of people to vote, the rise of parliaments that actually have power, the right, you know, the civil liberties, all of those things we think of as democratic, they're linked to the rise of a trade union movement. The 19th century, often socialism, but basically the trade union movement, whether it's Bismarck's Germany or Victorian England or France and the United States in toward the late 19th century. I mean, this is just historically, you just look at it. And then the 20th century, when we see whether it was the destruction of communism in Poland, with Solidarity helped do that, or whether it was the destruction of apartheid in South Africa, the trade union movements were essential, or the destruction of Franco's dictatorship. You just look at the world. And now today in China, the rise of worker protest and nascent forms of unionism are, you know, the engine that's pushing for more rights for Chinese workers. I mean, this is just historically the way it's been. And so, what's the opposite of that? Well, when trade unionism is destroyed, you get dictatorships. And what was the first thing that Hitler did in 1933? It wasn't his anti-Jewish, anti-Semitic. No, it was destroying the trade union movement, which he did on May 1st, 1933. They occupied every trade union hall in the Nazis did and destroyed the union movement. And that's true of all dictators. And so in the U.S., it's a slower and more difficult and, you know, process, but in fact, the destruction of the trade union movement means the United States would become a more authoritarian nation. And you can actually see this when, for example, curbing the right to vote is now one of the major pieces of agenda of the same conservative state legislatures, which have been curbing union rights and union collective bargaining in places like Wisconsin.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with Dr. Nelson Lichtenstein, the author of State of the Union, A Century of American Labor. Dr. Lichtenstein, in recent years, we've seen public sector union membership increase while private sector union membership has decreased. And you noted earlier that number is down to about 7% now in the United States. Tell us why that is.
Well, basically since the 80s, a public sector unionism has been sort of flat. It's sort of held its own. I think the reason is this, that in the private sector, for a variety of reasons, managers have really carte blanche to do whatever they want, legal or illegal, to really penalize those workers who want to form unions, whether it's firing them or all sorts of other things. And you know, the National Labor Relations Board doesn't really work, doesn't protect workers, and for a variety of reasons. In the public sector, the existence of a kind of civil service culture, a sort of sense that, you know, there is a kind of bureaucracy there, and that, you know, the long before unions came in, governments at different levels had a series of rules and regulations, and this, in a sense, gave a kind of protection to workers who could then speak out and do all sorts of things, and they couldn't. And the culture was, and then legally too, they couldn't be fired for doing that. So it's as if in the public sector, you still had the kind of National Labor Relations Board and that the Wagner Act envisioned in its first decade or two of existence, that in effect, workers have the right to speak out and to self-organize in the public sector, because that kind of culture of being fired or penalized is not there. Now I should say that in the South and in those states where there is not a provision for collective bargaining, there is no unionism. And I have found, and I spent a decade in Virginia and was involved in various activities there with public sector workers, to, you know, that there was a pervasive sense of fear. We in trying to overcome that among public sector workers, we pointed out that, you know, for example, at the University of Virginia where I taught, that in fact the personnel manager didn't have the right to fire you or demote you because you spoke out. That was within the, you know, even the Virginia, you know, statutes, and that helped us make some progress on that front. But I think that's the problem. Workers are not always heroes. They don't want to lose their jobs, and so you have to create a situation where, in the normal course of affairs, people can speak out, can self-organize, and then they can form unions.
So where does all this take us? Where's the future of the labor movement going?
Well, I mean, right now it's not looking. There are a lot of clouds. People were very hopeful that Obama and that this moment would create new rights for workers, whether in the public or the private sector. Clearly, you know, the Wisconsin events and Ohio too have indicated that, you know, the trade union movement has a lot of resources of, you know, moral and political and self-organizational to call upon, and that's great and that's important, and I think we need more of that. And I think it's very important that the unions, you know, declare a certain kind of declaration of independence, as it were, from the Democrats, from Obama, not in a kind of organizational sense, but, you know, we have our own agenda, we're going to pursue it, and whether this is helpful or hurtful to the Democrats is something that we left. We have to demonstrate our own independence. I think that's important. Maybe these demonstrations at Occupy Wall Street are part of that, but certainly the events in Wisconsin and Ohio were very inspiring, and I think more of that is needed.
Many times throughout the course of the history of the labor movement, one can look back and identify a defining moment in the labor movement. Do you think that we're in the middle of a defining moment for the labor movement?
I really don't know. Insofar as people like Walker and other conservatives would, you know, win, that would be defining in a bad way. but I do think that insofar as the unions turn back this very overt gambit, and the conservatives have a favorable moment because of the fiscal crisis, they're using that as an excuse. Then it would demonstrate that the unions do have a future, and one which, you know, relying on their own wherewithal, they can make the future brighter. I mean, I it's hard to say what a defining moment is. I mean, it isn't always a big strike, that's for sure, or even a big political battle. I think it's, you know, a sense of, you know, a sort of sense of a declaration of independence, a sort of, you know, we are self-organizing. That's the principle upon which labor is based, and its linkages, whether it's to companies or the Democratic Party, too closely. I think that can be a problem.
Dr. Nelson Lichtenstein, author of State of the Union, A Century of American Labor. Dr. Lichtenstein, thank you so much for your time and your expertise.
You're welcome.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll discuss contract negotiations at the Social Security Administration with AFGE SSA Council 220 President Witold Skierczynski.
Planning a family vacation? Did you know through your AFGE membership, you are eligible for discounts for you and your family when you travel to Busch Gardens, Adventure Island, Knott's Berry Farm, and SeaWorld? And if you want to capture those family moments on film, your union membership will help you get a discount on a camcorder or digital camera. Those are just some of the benefits offered by the American Federation of Government Employees, the nation's largest federal workers union, representing some 600,000 workers nationwide. If you are a member, simply go to the AFGE website and click on the Member Benefits tab or call 888-844-2343. That's 888-844-2343. Not a member? Become one. Log on to AFGE.org and click the Join AFGE button on the homepage. AFGE, proud to make America work.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Witold Skierczynski, the president of AFGE's Council 220, the National Council of SSA Field Operations Locals. Witold, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for inviting me.
So, the SSA Council is currently in contract negotiations with management. How are things going? What's the latest?
Yeah, we're it's not just the council, it's the SSA bargaining unit. We have four councils and two locals that are together negotiating a national contract, and we're at impasse. We submitted our contract to the Federal Services Impasses Panel 3 weeks ago. 20 days ago exactly, and so we're awaiting a decision by the panel whether to assert jurisdiction.
And what are you hoping to learn from the impasses panel? Where are you expecting it to go from here?
Well, we've sent there were 53 articles on the table. We've agreed to 13, so we have 40 articles in dispute. And the articles that we agreed to are minor for the most part. So most of our, the bulk of the contract has not been agreed to. We're hoping that the panel, we understand there's a massive dispute. And from what we have heard from them, that normally how they deal with massive disputes is they'll assign a fact finder to do mediation, if mediation is unsuccessful, the fact finder will issue recommendations to the panel, and then the panel will ask the parties to send a show cause letter and ask the parties if they have any disputes with regards to recommendations, and I guess the parties would write briefs, and then the panel would take into account the fact finder's recommendations and the briefs and make decisions on the individual articles. We understand that the panel members are part-time folks, and they're not really equipped to take a lengthy period of time and sit down with the parties and try to make a decision on all the disputed items. There's probably literally thousands of lines of language that are in dispute. So we feel that they'll probably ask a third party to try to assist the parties to get to an agreement and try to make recommendations to them about how to deal with the any disputed items after they make an attempt to have the parties reach agreement. So we think that's probably what's going to happen.
And
I don't know for sure, but that's my best guess.
And if it does get to a third party, are you confident that the third party is going to see some of the things that you're trying to achieve and work with you on that?
certainly a danger to have somebody else, you know, make a decision on contract negotiations. But I do feel that we're the union's in a good position. I think the agency came into these negotiations trying to take back a lot of union institutional rights, and they also came into the contract negotiations trying to prevent any agreement to have any additional employee benefits. In fact, they've come in trying to cut benefits. So, yeah, it's my feeling that despite the economic situation, there are areas in the contract that are not going to cost the agency any money or a lot of money, where a third party will see the fact that we'll see in our direction. I'll give you an example. Something like transit subsidies. My research shows that SSA is the only agency in government that doesn't pay maximum transit subsidies. They pay only maximum subsidies to employees who live in the Washington, D.C. area. And anyone outside of the Washington, D.C. area, they pay $65 a month. So I've researched at least 21 agencies' websites, and they all pay maximum transit subsidies to all their employees. So SSA has decided to have a two-class system, one for people who live in Washington and one for people who live outside of Washington. I don't think the panel will be too likely to agree that SSA should have a unique system of transit subsidies that doesn't exist in the rest of the government. So, I mean, that's like an area that I think we could probably prevail on. And I think there's a lot of others like that.
Vitold, why do you think that the agency is trying to take back union rights, trying to prevent additional employee benefits like these transit subsidies?
Well, it all stems from the leadership. I think Michael Astrew, the commissioner, is displayed in his 4 years plus as commissioner of Social Security that he's incredibly anti-union and that he has no desire to enhance benefits of the people who work in the agency. I mean, the SSA was the last agency in government to submit a forums proposal to OPM for approval because they kept insisting on having such a narrow, narrowly based pre-decisional involvement situation with the union. Ever since we've began our forums with the agency, the agency has resisted every step of the way engaging in any meaningful pre-decisional involvement. I think it's a philosophy that they have that they want to make decisions unencumbered with employer union input. I think we see it all across the country with regards to how they treat union officials with disdain and contempt, and we're seeing it all over the place. They have proposals on the table which would bar many of our union officials from even entering into their facilities where we represent employees. They want to exclude, they want to take away all space that we use to engage in confidential meetings with employees when they're filing grievances and any other EEO litigation or any other litigation. I mean, they have a definite attitude that they would like a union-free environment as much as possible.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with Vitold Skvirchinsky, president of AFGE's National Council of SSA Field Operations Locals. Vitold, is that even legal to bar a union official from entering the facility or using designated space?
Yeah, we think it's not legal. We think it's an unfair labor practice charge. Now, we haven't taken the position during bargaining to file charges against the agency for their proposals. You know, we suspect that, you know, as we get to this final phase of the process, that they'll modify their positions because no third party, we don't think, could ever agree that union officials would be barred from the premises. I mean, under their language, our national president would be barred from entering any facility in the country. What they've said is if you're not an employee of SSA, they can bar you from a union official from their facilities, and that's outrageous. That would mean our attorneys couldn't come into do arbitration cases on government space or engage in any kind of representational activity. Our staff or AFG national reps couldn't enter into space. Our organizers couldn't come in to do organizing. It's really outrageous what they're proposing.
Now, in addition to some of the topics that you mentioned here, when you look at the 40 disputed items left on the contract proposal, what are another couple of other issues that stand out?
Well, you know, health and safety, merit promotion, our appraisal article, hours of work, leave, employee rights, those are awards. Those are normally the heavy-hitting articles. I'll give you an example. On merit promotion, this agency is the only agency in government that I know of that doesn't score experience, awards, an appraisal in terms of ranking the best qualified candidates for a promotion. They have people fill out a questionnaire, and they pretty much, the questionnaire is scored, and the questionnaire is anybody who's taken the questionnaire can easily figure out how to max out on the points and give the right answers so that everyone basically scores the highest on the questionnaire, so they can put up a BQ list of everyone who applies and pick whoever they want. And you could see what we see happening throughout the country is that the people who are picked for merit promotion tend to be your younger employees with less experience. And we believe that's by design, an effort by the commissioner to change the culture, so to say, in SSA with younger, less experienced workforce who have less experience in a unionized environment and are more apt to be follow management's instructions without question. So, I think the merit promotion system is horrible. We've seen a lot of nepotism where relatives of management officials have been promoted and hired. We've seen a lot of younger employees get promotions over more qualified veteran employees. Their system discriminates against veterans. We've seen statistics to show that their veterans do very poorly on their in their promotion under their system. Their appraisal article, we've conceded, their three-tier appraisal system, since that's a management right. However, we've tried to put on the table a number of protections for employees. Basically, we think that our rights that employees should have of understanding how they're going to, what means the agency is going to use to evaluate their performance, what kind of scoring systems they're going to use, what kind of audit systems they're going to use, how those systems will be graded. We think that there needs to be an open book that both employees and managers know how the system works. And the agencies refuse to agree to any of our proposals in that area, and they basically want a secret system where they can without question, evaluate employees however they want without any objective basis. And that's something we'll never agree to. And, the agency hasn't changed their position in that area, so we're not interested in changing ours. And that's the reason we're at impasse. You look at the awards article, we've traditionally had over the years agreements with the agency about the pot that would be paid out in awards and the way it would be paid out for performance awards and other types of awards. And the agency now is refusing to agree to any language which specifies the amount of money they're going to devote to awards and how they're going to allocate award funds to our various offices, regions, and components. So that, without understanding what they're going to do, what the pot is and how it's going to be distributed, we can't have any agreement with them. You look at articles like leave, we've encountered all kinds of, because of the we presume the large workloads and the reduced staff. A lot of our employees are under stress. They're having all kinds of problems getting leave. The agency is engaged in some very questionable tactics on denying sick leave requests. And we've tried to negotiate some language where, again, you have objective criteria. If an employee has to present a medical certificate, you know, it would be the word of the doctor would be accepted. The agency currently questions oftentimes the validity of medical certificates and doesn't believe that physicians are telling the truth when they're saying that the employees are unable to work, which is astounding. So we're engaging a lot of litigation on that, and we're trying to come up with language that returns objective criteria to the leave request and approval process.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll continue with AFGE National Council of SSA Field Operations Locals President, Witold Skierczynski.
Attention AFGE members. Did you know about AFGE's new service to assist you with legal rights issues? It's called the AFGE Legal Rights Attorney Program, which offers free attorney representation in cases brought by AFGE councils and locals on behalf of AFGE members. The program, administered by AFGE's General Counsel's Office, has handled more than 150 cases since 2005 and has won millions of dollars in back pay for our members. The Legal Rights Attorney Program is designed to take cases that will be brought to arbitration, the Merit System Protection Board, or other review boards where both back pay and attorney's fees are available. These cases include removal, suspension, reduction in pay, reduction in grade, and furlough. For information about the program, please email legalrights@afge.org. Not a member? Become one and take advantage of this incredible resource today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We're continuing with Witold Skierczynski, president of AFGE's National Council of SSA Field Operations Locals. Witold, the council is planning a series of nationwide rallies this month. Tell us about them.
Yes, on October 27th, we're planning to have rallies at Social Security offices nationwide at around noon, lunch hour. And the purpose of the rallies is we're very concerned about the Deficit Commission and the proposals that the Deficit Commission will be sending to Congress around Thanksgiving time for an up or down vote on how to reduce $1.2 to $1.5 trillion from the current national deficit. And we're concerned that they may be looking at cuts in the Social Security benefit structure, as well as cuts in administrative expenses, which are used to service people who visit our offices, call our 800 number, or reach us through the internet to file claims and to engage in other Social Security business. We've already seen in this FY11 fiscal year a cut of about $1 billion from administrative expenses from the president's request for Social Security, which has led to some draconian measures such as a hiring freeze, an across-the-board hiring freeze. We're in a continuing resolution now, so we're under the same budget as FY11. We have an across-the-board hiring freeze. We have virtually no overtime. There's been a reduction in service at our offices of one-half hour. The commissioner decided to close our offices one-half hour earlier across the board throughout the country. He's eliminated the wage and benefit statement that, by law, has to be sent to every wage earner in the country, which gives them information about how much Social Security has on our records regarding how much they've earned and what their estimated benefit would be if they retired at either age 62 or age 66. So what we have there is some serious cuts in the administrative expenses. They've also closed over 300 contact stations, which are part-time offices that service the public many times in remote areas of the country. And they've closed 19 full-service offices. And we anticipate more of that if there's no additional funding for the agency. Our employees are concerned not only with their own situation, but also with the service, the effects that actions of the Deficit Commission and Congress could have on the American public. I mean, there's talk about increasing the retirement age. Any increase to the, for instance, an increase in the retirement age to age 69 would result in a 13% permanent cut in benefits for anyone on Social Security. And because that would also mean early retirement would increase to age 64. They're talking about using a different COLA formula, change CPI. That would result in after a beneficiary who's been receiving benefits for 20 years, say some of you retired at 65, at 85, they'd be losing $1,000 a year, which what we're dealing with are every day are folks that are live on the margins with about 35%. There's 58 million people right now getting Social Security benefits, and about 35% of them, that's their only income, and the average benefit is less than $1,200 a month. So it's not like they're getting rich on Social Security benefits. We have a big concern on the impact on the public, because these people, a lot of the people, over 50% of people receiving benefits, Social Security is their main source of income. So although Social Security has driven people out of poverty, a lot of people are on the margins of it, and any kind of cuts of this nature would adversely affect them. So what we've decided is, since we know best, we deal with the public every day, and we're on the front lines of taking claims and adjudicating claims for Social Security claimants, that our employees feel that they need to speak out about what the Deficit Commission is going to do. And their attitude is no cuts in Social Security benefits, because it didn't cause the deficit. Social Security had nothing to do with creating this deficit. It's run a surplus in its whole history. And second, no cuts. And in fact, we need increases in administrative expenses, because people who have paid taxes their whole lives deserve service when it comes time for them to file a claim. And so on October 27th at lunchtime, we'll be having rallies at a number of offices. We're right now don't have a list yet, but we're accumulating a list, should have a complete list by Monday, of facilities where we're going to have these rallies. And we're inviting other groups who have interest in Social Security issues, retiree groups, disability groups, other labor unions, AARP, the National Committee for the Preservation of Social Security and Medicare, Social Security Works, and other groups will be joining us with these rallies and trying to inform the public and also Congress of the dangers that could occur with any cuts in the benefit structure and any cuts in or not properly funding administrative expenses for running the agency.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with Witold Skwierczynski, president of AFGE's National Council of SSA Field Operations Locals. Witold, if people out there listening want to participate in their respective communities, where can they go to learn more about the rallies?
Well, we're going to put up a list of offices on our website. So our website is www.afgec220.org. So as we start to get a solid list, we're going to put that list up on our website, and we would urge people, if they're interested in attending a rally, we'll have a list of the sites right on the website, and they can check it out and go to that site. And they'll be around noon on October 27th. And it'll be during the lunch hour of our employees. They'll be taking their lunch hour. Nobody's going to be there on government time. They'll be on lunchtime. And so our lunches tend to be a half hour long. We have probably two lunches in most offices. So our rallies won't be more than an hour. And hopefully folks out there, if they're concerned about these issues, like our employees are and like our constituent groups who are going to join us, please come out. If there's a site in your community, and spend an hour of your time and let the public know that you have the same concerns about the deficit commission and that you aren't interested in having any cuts in the Social Security program or in the administration of it.
Now, on this notion of cuts, particularly to the customers' benefits, are you finding that people coming into the offices, the field offices, are talking about it? They're expressing concerns over what's being proposed to their benefits?
Yeah, we're getting more calls on the 800 number about it. You know, anytime there's any kind of, and when people come into our offices, they talk about it. Anytime there's any news about issues affecting Social Security, the public calls us up. Now, you know, we can't really advocate, our employees can't really advocate that they, you know, call up their congressman or write their senator. They're going to give them a straight answer saying, you know, these things are undetermined as of this time and no action has been taken. Follow your newspapers or follow your media and you know, for any further information. But, yeah, we're getting more inquiries.
And, Vitold, you've mentioned that some of the decisions that have been made by the agency in terms of office closures and things like that and reduction in hours, open hours, have been made unilaterally. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think, you know, the commissioner is that comes straight from Commissioner Astrew. I think his attitude is that he doesn't feel obligated, despite the executive order that President Obama signed asking agencies to engage in pre-decisional involvement with their unions on issues like this. He feels he doesn't have to. I mean, the decision to close offices a half hour early was not made with any consultation with the union in advance. He cut the awards budget this year because of guidance from OMB that it should only be 1% of payroll awards, and he went below that to 0.75%. He didn't consult with us on reasons for that. He restricted overtime in field offices to certain days, to only Saturdays and not during the week. He didn't consult with us on that. He is just a person who has, and in fact, on the office closings, which is really troublesome, the office closings are done pretty much unilaterally. They claim they contact Congress in advance, but they really don't contact the community. There's no effort to have community input in whether and what the impact would be of an office closing on that community. They should have community hearings before an office closes. I mean, a Social Security office is an important piece of a community. That's where people go to get advice and assistance on their federal pensions from Social Security. That's where they go to file claims. That's where they go if they have problems. To take away that face-to-face ability can have a serious impact on a community. And Mr. Astrew has decided that he isn't interested in community input. He's not interested in what the public thinks on whether an office should be in their communities, and he's not interested in what the public thinks on how their service will be changed if an office is closed. And I think that's a sad statement that a government official in that high of a position isn't interested in what the public's opinion is regarding having an office in their community.
Vitold Skvirchinsky, President, AFGE National Council of SSA Field Operations Locals. Vitold, as always, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you to our guests this week, author and labor historian Dr. Nelson Lichtenstein and AFGE SSA Council 220 President Vitold Skvirchinsky. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and that's The View from Inside Government.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power.